Governor Kristi Noem issues an executive order that bans the Department of Education from applying for federal grants that prioritize critical race theory. Today is Thursday, July 29th, and this is In the Moment. From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, coming up this hour, we've invited you in July to what we've been calling SDPB Summer School. Well, today we recap some of that coverage with a focus on critical race theory, social studies standards updates, and how to talk about history's heated topics. Also this hour, we long for rain with Eliza Blue. We hear the crack of the bat from a new baseball league. And we explore a collaboration that can keep garbage can lids closed in a South Dakota windstorm or print 3D parts for an aircraft. We're broadcasting live today from the Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first.
With South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Jenna Scott. A pop-up clinic makes getting a COVID-19 vaccine more accessible. South Dakota Voices for Peace collaborated with South Dakota Urban Indian Health and SDSU Dairy Extension on a recent clinic at the Empire Mall in Sioux Falls. Michaela Sieber is the CEO of South Dakota Urban Indian Health. She says getting out into the community was eye-opening.
A lot of people were concerned about the side effects of vaccines. They had heard some scary things. They were very anxious about that. So this was something they just drove by and saw and thought, I'll give it a try. And we talked through the side effects with them.
Sieber says accessibility was key.
Another big thing was people were on their way to or from work and they just saw us and stopped by. And their shift work or their hours just didn't allow for them to maybe go across town to make an appointment. So this was just convenient.
The clinic administered the one-dose Johnson & Johnson vaccine. Sieber says the groups plan to hold more walk-up clinics. The state's vaccination pace has slowed. About 53% of residents 12 and older are fully vaccinated. That figure has changed only 2 percentage points since the end of June. Congress is taking another look at how the pandemic affected the beef supply chain, as well as market manipulation by packers. South Dakota's congressional delegation has been pushing for months for investigations into both of those issues. U.S. Representative Dusty Johnson says market deficiencies that were exposed during the pandemic aren't going away.
We don't have enough processing capacity. And that is a market failure that has negative impacts both to consumers who want to eat the beef as well as producers who are trying to raise it. And we need to figure out how to increase that capacity. The lack of capacity has hindered the American rancher's ability to reap some of the benefits of an increasing demand and increasing appetite for beef across the world.
The Senate Judiciary Committee is examining possible improper and anti-competitive activity among four large meat packers. Senator John Thune requested the hearing. He says one of his top priorities is supporting cattle producers and making sure they have fair and transparent markets for the commodities they produce. A South Dakota congressman wants to repurpose COVID-19 relief funds for mental health resources. Republican Dusty Johnson of South Dakota and Democrat Kim Schreier of Washington are co-sponsoring the bill. It aims to let states and tribes move previously allocated money into a trust fund for behavioral health services. The Centers for Disease Control report levels of depression, anxiety, suicidal thoughts, and substance abuse increased during the pandemic. Johnson says it's important to acknowledge that, quote, people's lives and livelihoods were completely disrupted last year. He says that took a toll on many Americans' mental health. And for your weather today, it's mostly sunny skies and hot out east. They'll be seeing highs in the 80s. Out west, we'll be getting a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms in the afternoon. Otherwise, mostly sunny for a high near 90. And later on tonight, a chance of showers and thunderstorms is possible for the entire state. Out west, we'll be having a 90% chance of precipitation, along with wind gusts as high as 23 miles per hour. We'll also all be seeing lows in the 60s. And in addition to our daily news coverage, SDPB's reporting team does monthly deep dive investigations of the news and events that affect our lives in South Dakota. For any stories, you can go check out our website, that is sdpb.org/news. Again, sdpb.org/news. With South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Jenna Scott.
And I'm Lori Walsh. Extreme heat continues across much of South Dakota. Even the nights are hot. Even the soil is hot. Laura Edwards is the South Dakota State University Extension State Climatologist, and she's joining us now for an update on this week's Drought Monitor. Laura, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Hi. Thank you, Lori.
Can I ask you first about the haze? Because I think a lot of people are wondering and having a hard time with breathing and eyes stinging. What exactly are we seeing with this haze and smoke?
Yeah, it sure got really smoky this morning with smoke coming down from the wildfires up in Canada on that north-northeast wind that we've had today. And it really is smelling like a campfire right next door. And it's just being carried in. I know Minnesota had some air quality alerts out today. Certainly it's getting pretty smoky out there.
Yeah, and coming from wildfires in Canada. Let's talk a little bit about the heat and the drought conditions. How has the situation changed in the past week as we look at the new drought monitor map, which is released on Thursday mornings?
Yeah, we've had some extreme heat the last couple of days earlier this week, of course, but some of that heat came after the data cutoff for the drought monitor map. Their data cutoff is Tuesday morning, just to give them time to put the map together. But just based on rainfall recently over the last few weeks, we have seen some improvements, particularly over Lyman County in the central part of the state, and Charles Mix area down that way, but also some degradation, some areas getting worse in western Brown County and Hawkins-Stanley County in the central part of the state. So kind of a mixed bag, just really trying to capture who's getting rain and who's not at this point.
Yeah, what does our outlook look like for the days ahead?
You know, it looks like you just heard the forecast for the mm-hmm. next day or so, but the rain that we're going to see the next day is about it for the next week. We're going to see temperatures closer towards average, you know, highs in the 80s, lows around 60, but really not much for rain to speak of. And as we look out ahead 1 to 2 weeks from now into towards middle of August, looks like hot weather is coming again, more likely than not, especially in the northern part of the state, and also continued dry conditions as well. So this drought is just hanging in with us. It's not going to go away, it looks like, at least any substantial amount in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah. So what about the impact of some of those high temperatures that last in the evening? How does that impact things and just the heat of the soil itself when you dig it down in the soil and it's hot and dry?
Yeah, there's a couple things there. You know, we see our plants stress a lot from garden and lawns all the way to row crops of corn and soybeans, really stressing a lot in those hot days. You see them kind of turn gray or flip their leaves to kind of reduce how much sun they get, how much heat they take in. But also animals, livestock, well, humans too. You don't get that chance to cool off at night. And I haven't heard yet of any significant livestock losses yet, but hopefully they all were able to carry through. The humidity really is different than that heat we saw in June, which was really dry, with lows in the 50s, highs in the 100s. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's a lot different when we have higher humidity.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about the role of citizen scientists in this. If people have information when they look at your report and say, that's not what I'm seeing on the ground, are they participating in this feedback as you gather your scientific research?
Yes, absolutely. You know, we're always looking for reports from the field, so to speak. And we've got a couple ways to do that. One is through our COCORAS network, Community Collaborative Rain, Hail, and Snow Network. And those are volunteer weather watchers all across the state, report rain and snow in the wintertime. And they can also, if they're registered there, you can also sign up to do a condition report, is what we call it. Just letting us know if you're wetter, drier than average, maybe share a picture or two on what things look like out your way. similar on the University of Nebraska website. They have a drought impact reporter where anyone can submit a report. You don't even need a login. You just go on their website, tell them basically kind of what county you're in, and share some comments. Tell us how bad the drought is where you are. We can see that, and the drought monitor authors can see that as well to hopefully improve and get the most accurate picture of drought across the state each week.
Yeah. Any final thoughts you have before we let you go?
You know, I think we've seen a lot of impacts in spring crops, but I think summer crops like corn and soybeans yet to be determined. And water restrictions, I think, are kind of on the horizon. We'll be watching closely at a rural water and the larger cities on how those water supplies hang in there through the drought. Mm.
Laura Edwards is the SDSU Extension State Climatologist. You can find all of our drought coverage on our website at sdpb.org/news. If you have a drought impact story you'd like to share with us, you can send us an email inthemoment@sdpb.org, or you can text us 605-956-7372. That's 956-SDPB. Dr. Edwards, thanks for being here.
All right, thank you.
Ahead on the program, Innovation Through Collaboration, we talk about a partnership between South Dakota Mines, Ellsworth Air Force Base, and the U.S. Department of Defense. You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Some athletes' Olympic dreams are now playing out in Tokyo. One cyclist's journey ended before the games, with broken bones, medical bills, and a fight with his insurance provider.
I was pretty mad because in my head I'm like, why am I better at your job of finding a surgeon than you are? You know, I shouldn't have been in that much pain for those days.
Our July Bill of the Month this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Listen, beginning at 3 Central, 2 Mountain, on SDPB.
Program funding by Bangs McCullen Law Firm. From humble beginnings in the Dakota Territory over 130 years ago, now a full-service firm with offices in Sioux Falls and Rapid City. There for you then, here for you now. BangsMcCullen.com.
Walk out the door and your world changes. Dark to light, quiet to noise. The stars, the sounds of insects and birds, kids playing, waves crashing, cars passing. Even in our most peaceful moments, the world is always moving, changing. Something big is happening somewhere. Take NPR with you and stay connected to the world outside your door. Listen live on your phone, at this station's website, or npr.org.
Listen at sdpb.org or download our app.
Program funding is provided by First Dakota National Bank. First Dakota National Bank celebrates individuals and businesses with a passion to turn their dreams into South Dakota firsts. Learn more at firstdakota.com/first.
Science and technology reporting is supported by Black Hills Information Security.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. Next, we're going to explore the innovation of collaboration in a new partnership that includes South Dakota Mines in Rapid City, Ellsworth Air Force Base, and the U.S. Department of Defense. Jason Combs is the University Program Director with the National Security Information Network at Mines. That's a U.S. Department of Defense program headquartered in Washington, D.C. But Jason Combs joins us today from the SDPB Black Hills Surgical Hospital Studio in Rapid City. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Lori, thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit about your role itself as you kind of navigate the collaboration. What are some of the goals of what you're doing here?
Yeah, my role out here is to really tap into all the talent pool that's in the local area, specifically at the School of Mines, but it's not just limited to the School of Mines. And it's all about also identifying problems that are out at the Air Force Base in any DOD unit that's out there. So it could be the guard unit, could be the guard camps, it could be somebody that's outside of the local area. But generally speaking, this coming year, we're really going to be focusing on relationships of Ellsworth and South Dakota School of Mines.
All right. So solving problems can be very simple, can be very complex. Tell me about the garbage can lids, because this is a simple example, but yet kind of revolutionary.
Yeah, it's an interesting story because it's probably like the best story you could ever hope to make up, and it actually happened. So I arrived about a year ago, and we were just starting this collaboration with Ensign, the National Security Innovation Network, and the School of Mines. And we were trying to source problems from the base. Sounds very easy, but it's difficult to actually get a framed up, solvable problem in a semester. Mm. And one of the problems that came up at the last minute was blowing trash cans and blowing trash across South Dakota, which I think all of us are familiar with. And I reached out to my network of other program directors throughout the United States, which there's about 17 other people here. And I was like, hey, I don't have room. We've missed kind of the academic cycle with the School of Mines just based on timing. I've got this problem, and it's a trash can problem, and nobody was interested in it. And actually, a teaching team out of San Diego State thought it was a wonderful problem for a mechanical engineering team, senior design course. And so they took that on, and I think some of the key parts of it that made it such a success is the base was actively engaged in the problem solving, and were not just showing up for meetings, but they were actually taking what the students were giving them, and they were giving them really good feedback. And then the teaching team was really, really engaged to make sure that the students were listening to what the base was saying. The end result was actually a piece of hardware that was patentable, and the base is in the process of printing about 500 of those for the trash cans with their additive manufacturing capability. So a great story, and I'm hoping we can do this more and more. So
yeah. So what happens after the students then, or the researchers who are involved with that kind of problem, they have an opportunity at this point to sort of continue it on with a patent, with a business? What are some of the choices that they can make at this point?
Yeah. So there's a lot of different avenues from Ensign's standpoint. Ideally, what we like to see or would like to see is, in a case like this, the team or somebody else to pursue commercialization of it. What that does is it actually scales out the product and also keeps it relevant, because you have enough of a customer base in addition to the DoD mm-hmm. that obviously you wouldn't see necessarily a trash can lid, you know, being innovated that much year over year. But yeah. Ideally what we want is we want to be able to scale that. So we do have interest from Grand Forks. They're interested in purchasing it. And that's another problem that we're actively looking at, trying to figure out how do we take this technology that the student team produced, and how do we make sure that that's available to not only the other Air Force bases or installations out there, but also commercialized if there's other people that want it.
I think it's a great example to look at, you know, beginning with a problem and moving on to the next steps. Give us a more broader thinking sort of national security, problem solution.
Yeah, one of the challenges that Ellsworth is tackling right now, and it's not just related to them, but it's energy resilience. So the military is looking at having less reliance on not only fossil fuels, but other fuels, and looking on how they can be independent. And it's a really, really large, complex problem, because you're dealing with multiple technologies that have different levels of readiness, different levels of commercialization application. I'll use hydrogen fuel cells as an example, but it's definitely something they need to start thinking about. And so Ellsworth has actually utilized a couple of the Ensign programs. One is called Experts, where they got paired up with energy experts from one of the schools was Fletcher, to help them understand what questions they should be asking. They've also utilized a program that we called X-Force Fellowship, which this year we have two School of Mines students and we have another student from Penn State that are actually doing a lot of work on helping the base develop some decision tools on choices, so they can better understand trade-offs when they're looking at energy storage, energy production, transmission of energy, et cetera, on the base. So that one's a much larger impactful probably long-term, but obviously it's not gonna be solved overnight. So what we look for is really an iterative solution. So at the end of each program, Ellsworth has value that they can move forward with. And so we talk about building a skateboard instead of trying to shoot for an automobile right away. Mm-hmm. So what is the smallest product we can make that actually has a fully functional capability that the base can put into action? And then we build upon that, try to make it better the next year.
What are the opportunities for you as the leader of this program when you see some of these new students,
these students that have not yet entered their careers, are they thinking about things with a freshness that is noticeable? Like how, talk a little bit about the advantages and the, you know, what the students themselves bring to the table.
Yeah, I think that's twofold. So one that's really interesting is we have these summer teams right now, and this is just one of about 20 programs that Ensign has. And their feedback to me is they're really interested and excited because you'll have two mechanical engineering students, but they come from different universities. And so they're tackling a problem, and they'll come at it with the different course experiences they have. Mm. And they've found that very, very interesting and valuable. So I think it's really enjoyable for them. From my standpoint, it is. It's great because they're getting brought into the mix with a lot of maybe current software or hardware that we may not be familiar with. But then you take and you put them out on the base, and they see, like, no kidding, high-end technology in place. And so I think both the base and the students are actually getting a fresh look just from different perspectives. I think the students were really, really impressed, and this is dealing with the additive manufacturing at the base, with the technology that the base had. Mm. And they hadn't had access to that. But the base also didn't know that there were certain softwares out there that they could be utilizing. And so, again, it's a win-win from both the student and the DoD side.
Yeah. Jason Combs is the National Security Information Network University Program Director at South Dakota Mines. Thank you so much for stopping by today for the update. We appreciate it.
Yeah, Lori, thank you for the time.
Ahead on the program this July, we invited you to join us for a little SDPB summer school as we discussed history's heated topics. We're going to recap that coverage after the break. You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
On the next Fresh Air, Spyware, we talk with Washington Post reporter Craig Timberg about how a private Israeli spyware company leased military-grade spyware to governments that were supposed to use it for tracking terrorists and criminals, but it was used to hack the phones of journalists, human rights activists, business executives, and others. Join us.
This afternoon at 2, 1 Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding by ReliaBank, personal and business banking solutions, reliable services, and a friendly welcome at 9 locations across eastern South Dakota. ReliaBank, a brighter banking experience since 1920. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Stay up to date with South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Sign up for newsletters from SDPB. You can learn more about what's happening at our studios, get encapsulated news, see previews of specials, and so much more. SDPB in your inbox. Sign up online at sdpb.org.
Program funding with your support and by McCrory Gardens in Brookings, planting over 40,000 flowers every spring. More information at McCroryGardens.com. McCrory Gardens, ready to bloom.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. Critical race theory has never been part of the curriculum in South Dakota K-12 schools. Critical race theory is not the same thing as multicultural education. It's not the same thing as diversity, inclusion, and equity training. It's not a political ideology. Critical race theory was devised by legal scholars in the 1970s to help examine racism at institutional and structural levels. Its foundational questions looked at ways law might uphold racial hierarchies or the ways law might dismantle white supremacy in America. It's advanced thinking, sure, and different scholars have different takes on its validity and its application, yes. At its core, though, is this idea of striving for American equality, which on the surface seems like an ideal most people would at least agree was important. So what is all the fuss about? Well, we've spent the month of July spotlighting what we called here on SDPB as summer school. And during that time, we've talked a lot about critical race theory in this context. We also talked about the regular revision of statewide social studies standards, and we explored some really tough elements of our history: manifest destiny, government boarding schools, the politics of patriotism and education. We also got to know the people who are sharing the story of our history with students and with visitors from around the world. We're going to recap a bit today with just a sprinkling of highlights from those conversations this month. We're going to begin with Brian Maher. He's Executive Director and CEO of the South Dakota Board of Regents. What are you hearing as you listen intently to different people that they are worried about in this broader conversation about diversity and inclusion?
Boy.
I know that's a really tough question.
You know, it's emotionally charged.
Okay.
I hear that with a great frequency. And honestly, I hear people with different points of view really asking that same question.
Yeah.
What is the big deal? And I hear that from people who might be squarely on one side of the topic, and I hear it from people who might be squarely on the other side of the topic. So I think maybe the big deal is we need to continue conversations and just kind of get to the core of having an understanding of what it is that we're talking about, and we might begin just with some definitions of just what it is that we're talking about.
If we were going to set some guideposts for our summer school project, that would be guidepost number one, by the way. Begin with definitions. When you're talking with someone about patriotic education, it's a good idea to ask them what they mean with the word patriotic. What does someone mean when they say systemic racism? What do they mean by white supremacy? Next, we hear from Ben Jones. He is South Dakota's state historian. Let me be clear. I did not talk to Ben Jones about critical race theory. I listened carefully to his new podcast. It's called History 605, and it's created in partnership with the State Historical Society and South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Well, in episode number one, Jones lays out some historical fallacies, and he uses examples from his own research to help listeners think more deeply about their assumptions.
So the first one is one I see used frequently by all kinds of people when they're thinking about something historical, and that's called presentism. This favors things that are easily recognized by us and ignores or misunderstands things that are no longer around. So when you wind up doing this, when you use the presentism fallacy, it's hard to accurately understand the event or the people involved. And what's most relevant to us may have nothing to do with the issue at the time.
I'm going to call that our second guidepost. Consider history in its full context. Now, that doesn't mean making excuses. Plenty of slave owners knew that owning another human being was immoral, for example. But for more on that, we also turn to Patrick Hicks, because I asked him to provide context for poets from history whose opinions or actions we find reprehensible today. Here he is talking about reconsidering Rudyard Kipling.
And I'm not in favor of saying we can't read these people anymore because we find their ideas ideologically repulsive. And certainly I do with Rudyard Kipling. And yet I recognize, you know, the value of his poems. So I think that if we can couch it in historical terms, not in any way as an apology, but as a way to frame the space that this writer comes from, I think that's really important. And I do this because I kind of think about the artists that are producing work today, myself included. I mean, who knows how we're going to be remembered 100 years from now? That's like someone else's problem. Mm-hmm. But I am a product of my time, and I'm sure that there are things that I'm doing right now that maybe I'm not as aware as I should be. I mean, maybe 100 years from now, people that are not really defending the environment are going to be as repulsive to that generation as racist British imperialists are today. I mean, we just have no way of knowing, so I think it's important to frame the time that someone comes from.
All right, let's get back to critical race theory. Here is political scientist Pam Caravu from Black Hill State University making the argument that maybe when emotions are high and things are tense, maybe we aren't talking about that thing we thought we were talking about in the first place.
But actually, critical race theory doesn't ascribe racism to white people as individuals or even as a group. Instead, it focuses on U.S. institutions and systems, basically arguing that these systems were built when racism was prevalent, and they still retain racist components today that lead to differential outcomes by race, or you could even do this and talk about it by gender. So racism can still exist without racists. That's critical race theory in a nutshell. But I don't think we're really debating about critical race theory in any of these conversations. I mean, I thank you for the opportunity to kind of clarify what it means, but this is a moral panic that's being used for political purposes. It's like all the people in the 1980s that were very worried about rock music and Satanism and that kind of thing. It's a convenient political tool more so than a serious conversation about race or critical race theory or even what should or shouldn't be taught in public education.
That is our summer school guidepost number 3. Some people want to get other people worked up, mobilized, divided, offended. Think about what exactly you're getting mobilized for. Is it in line with your beliefs and your values? Is the person calling you to action acting with integrity and good intentions? Are you speaking and behaving with integrity and good intentions? Here's Professor Stephen Jackson from the University of Sioux Falls. He's part of this working group that is recommending revisions to the state social studies standards. Those are scheduled to be released soon from the South Dakota Department of Education for public input. I asked Professor Jackson for his advice as the process of evaluating those standards continues.
So I think my first advice is just to say, don't get angry before you actually look at this. There's so much out there, and there's a national conversation going on about really contentious topics, and there's people that are hurling accusations at one another, and it gets really deep in the mud. Don't pay attention to that. Read the work first, and read what we've come up with. Those will be done next week. They'll be released to the public, so you'll have access to them on the South Dakota Department of Education website. Read that first. Compare it to what we currently have. In many cases, we left a lot of this alone. We made relatively minute changes to others. Sometimes we added some new things. Most of what we added was to include perspectives from Indigenous Native Americans, to have more South Dakota content available in our standards. So read it yourself first, I think, is the most important thing. And then I'd say talk to a teacher. Talk to teachers about what their experience is, how they see these standards, because I think some of the problem that gets translated is some of this stuff is it's in education jargon, and we try to do as good as we could to take some very technical concepts from education and putting it in language we think everybody can understand, but we're not always successful in that. And so sometimes there can be some miscommunication about what we mean with certain terms or those kind of things. So I'd really encourage you, go talk to your local teachers, talk to your children's teachers and what their experience is and what they see with these standards. Go to those things first, and also just sort of keep it all in a perspective. Standards are never perfect.
They're not curriculum.
They are not curriculum. So they're not like a syllabus like you'd see. Yeah. This is everything that you're going to do every single day. Mm-hmm. They're a statement of minimums. Every district is expected to sort of go beyond this and to really flesh it out into the lesson plans that children will be experiencing daily.
And here is our fourth and final guidepost. This one comes from Shankar Vedantam. It's a little bit longer because it's in the form of a thought experiment and a story. Vedantam is the host of the podcast, The Hidden Brain, and his latest book is called Useful Delusions. I asked him, by way of example, how we should consider places like Mount Rushmore in South Dakota as national beacons to ideals like freedom and equality. Here is the path he invited us to walk down.
You know, let me run a quick thought experiment by you. Social scientists sometimes talk about, the proverbial anthropologist from Mars. You know, what would happen if someone visited us from another planet? What would they see? How would they see us? I want to push it a step further. Imagine you have a visitor who's coming to us from a distant galaxy, many hundreds or thousands of light years away. And this person travels across vast realms of space and time and arrives at this tiny little planet in this obscure solar system, in this nondescript galaxy in one tiny part of the universe. And it's a beautiful planet, this blue planet that's sort of floating in the sky here. And this person from this other galaxy discovers that there are 8 million species living on this planet. But one of these species, human beings, believe that they have the right to carve up this little planet into 190 different territories that they call nations. And they believe so deeply and so fervently in the reality of the lines that they have drawn that they are willing to go to war with one another and not just fight one another, but they're willing to destroy not just each other, but destroy the entire planet because they have armed themselves with nuclear weapons and they would rather destroy the entire planet than sacrifice the integrity of the lines that they have drawn. Now, surely this visitor from a distant galaxy would say, this is clearly a grand delusion. This is a huge delusion that not only millions of people believe in the reality and sanctity of their nations, but they're willing to die for it. They're willing to kill for it. They're willing to destroy the planet over them. Now, you can look at this and basically say, well, nations are a delusion and therefore absurd. But I actually take a slightly different tack, which is I ask, well, why is it that nations came into being? If you accept that, in fact, nations are lines drawn in the sand by human beings. In some ways, they're inventions of the human mind. They are what I would call a delusion. Why do they come into existence? What purpose do they serve? And I would argue that nations, in fact, these delusions that we have about the groups that we live in, serve a very important purpose. So when there's a natural disaster in South Dakota, someone in New York might feel, I need to come to the aid of the people living in South Dakota because, in fact, the people in South Dakota and I are part of this larger group. We're all American. So in some ways, the stories that we tell about who we are and the nations to which we belong allow us to stand shoulder to shoulder with other people. They allow us to accomplish great things together. So when you have contested histories of the founding fathers or contested histories of nations, in some ways, these should not be surprising because all nations in some ways are held together by these stories. And of course, if you look at the founding stories of any nation, United States included, what you will often find is that these stories are based on myths and half-truths and incomplete accounts of what actually happened. And if you look very closely, you can say, well, this is not actually the story of America. The real story of America is something else. But I think that misses the point. The role that the story is playing is not just a factual account of what happened. The role of the story is playing is almost the form of glue. It's holding people together in exactly the same way that stories hold our personal lives together. Stories hold our interpersonal relationships together. Stories also hold groups and nations together. It's not surprising in some ways that those stories are contested, but the fact that they are contested does not necessarily mean that they are worthless.
What if some people are left out of that story?
Indeed, this has often been the case with many nations and many stories. And in fact, it's the story of the United States as well. The stories that the United States has told about its own founding have changed significantly over the last 250 years. And as new groups have basically acquired some political power, they basically said, look, we've been left out of the conversation. The stories now need to include us. And very smart leaders, skilled leaders, in some ways are able to weave together the stories of the past with the stories of the present. So I'm not suggesting for a second that these stories need to be static. In some ways, the very fact the stories are supple, they're malleable, they're adaptable, they evolve, these things are actually what give the stories their power because as time evolves, as the decades unfold, you know, the story that makes sense to you and I today might not make sense to our children 30 years from now. And it's left to them in some ways to reinvent the stories, to draw from the past, but also to draw from the present and weave together a new story of what it means to be an American.
Of course, we are not done talking about social studies standards or critical race theory or education or South Dakota history. Today, Governor Kristi Noem signed Executive Order 2021-11. It bars the South Dakota Department of Education from applying for any federal grants tied to critical race theory, even if the words critical race theory are not referred to directly in the grant priorities. The governor also earlier requested a review of policies by the South Dakota Board of Regents to ensure the state's higher education system remains focused on what she calls honest, patriotic education. You can find all our coverage on this month's Spotlight topic on our website at sdpb.org/spotlight. Let's take a moment now to consider the longing for a summer rain shower. Here's Eliza Blue's July postcard from the prairie.
This summer has been hot and dry. The seeds I planted in the spring had a hard time germinating because the soil temperature went from cold to very hot so abruptly. Their struggles continued as sunny day after sunny day sucked moisture from the prairie soil until it cracked. Out in the pasture, the grass stopped growing and began to dry to bronze and amber. The only thing that wasn't stilled by drought was the wind, endless in its whispers and howls. Even the short grass in the yard is yellow and sharp. We watered it a little at first, but it's too hot and dry to justify that now. So the kids can't run barefoot without complaining. The grass is hurting me. The only green left on the ground is burdock and dandelions, which somehow still manage to thrive. Even the leaves on the trees are beginning to yellow around the edges, though we are a long way from autumn. In the last few weeks, we've watched storm after storm rise up on the western horizon, the clouds in the distance a deep blue reaching all the way to the ground, threads of bright lightning sizzling through them. But the rain never reaches us. It always shifts north or south, leaving us with only a few sprinkles, barely enough to settle the dust. Finally, one evening, a storm begins to build, the winds growing stronger by the second. The kids and I go out to watch the sky while the man of the ranch watches the radar. "Looks like there might be hail," he says. So we move lambs into the barn and vehicles under cover. When the rain arrives, though, it is gentle, making a playful patter that reminds me of my childhood spent in more subtle climates. The kids ask to go out with their umbrellas. "Why not?" I say. The clouds overhead are soft gray, not the deep blue or sickly green of thunder or hail. It is barely more than a sprinkle as the kids run out beneath their umbrellas, laughing and shouting. The momentum builds slowly as they play, the drops growing fatter and falling faster until it is a lush, steady rain that we Dakotans dream about but rarely get to experience. Instead of a storm, we've gotten a warm summer shower. "Put down your umbrellas," I yell to the kids as I leap barefoot out the door. "We are going for a rain run." "Rain run, rain run," we chant as we splash around the gravel circle between the house, barn, and shop. Sharp stones poke at our toes, but the thickening mud softens our footfalls so it barely hurts. "Puddles," the kids shout, and quite suddenly, the dusty divots in the yard are rapidly expanding into chains of narrow rivers and tiny lakes. "Rain run," we sing again as we circle, our toes sinking into the mud, our calves and ankles splattered brown. The rain begins to slow, the drops scattering like mist. A lemon-yellow glint seeps through the thinning veil of gray, and just like that, the clouds move on. We watch them passing over our neighbor's pasture to the east. The kids run to the biggest puddle and begin their work, digging, splashing, rerouting its current down the driveway, piling up rocks to build a tiny island. And I return to the kitchen to start supper. We all go to bed that night with feet a slightly darker shade of tan than our legs, a faded ring of dirt just above our ankles. Of course, we should have washed them off, but I couldn't bring myself to remove that christening of mud, and the sheets needed washing anyway. Across the prairie, the moisture lays like a blanket across the grass, soaking down slowly, mending the cracked soil, softening the brittle stems. In our beds, the mud seeps into our dreams as well, softening them too.
More information about Eliza Blue is available online at elizablue.net. Ahead on the program, the blossoming of echinacea, South Dakota Home and Garden, is next. You're in the moment on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
I'm Robin Young. The new documentary, Ailey, tells the story of the legendary choreographer Alvin Ailey, dance giant Judith Jameson, remembers performing his works.
You got up there and burnt up the stage and didn't leave anything for anybody else who was coming in after you to dance on because you had already done it all.
Next time, Here and Now.
This afternoon, beginning at 1 Central, Noon Mountain, on SDPB Radio.
Program funding by the South Dakota Humanities Council. Promoting reading for all ages with the 2021 Young Readers One Book, Imagine Imahina, by Juan Felipe Herrera, featuring English and Spanish text. More at sdhumanities.org.
It is dry out here in the West, real dry. So bad that lakes are drying up, and so too are businesses that depend on them.
The restaurant's just not busy. So they're taking other seasonal jobs and moving on.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Climate change and tourism on the water. While it's there, next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6:30 Central, 5:30 Mountain on SDPB Radio.
Program funding with your support and by Ingalls Homestead, Laura's Living Prairie, sharing Laura Ingalls Wilder's pioneer heritage through covered wagon rides and hands-on activities. Online at IngallsHomestead.com.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. Today, we consider the coneflower for our South Dakota Home and Garden segment. Eric Helland is president and CEO of Landscape Garden Centers in Sioux Falls, and he is joining me in the SDPB Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls to talk echinacea. Hey, welcome back.
Hi, Lori. How are you?
I am well. Think daisy in some ways.
That's what you think?
So this is a daisy family. Tell me a little bit about, so, you know, you look this up online, sure, and it's a riot of color.
Right.
But describe the riot of color and the shape of this flower, because you're on the radio. This is what you have to do.
So we are going to describe a flower. So the coneflowers have a very, very simple leaf, and they will begin flowering basically late May, June, July, and throughout the summertime. And the center of the coneflower, which kind of that's where it gets its name, is cone-shaped. Mm-hmm. And the eye of the flower is kind of, that will actually have different colors within it. So you have the leaf petal, or the flower petal, which will be different colors. Those will be oranges, yellows, whites, purples. And the center of it will be typically a darker color, but there's some of them that will be green. There'll be black with a hint of white. Mm. Yellow, there'll be a hint of yellow in there. So they're all various colors. And basically that center of the flower is where the seeds are. Once the petals of the flower basically goes through its whole transition stage from budding to blooming to just basically living its life. So those are the seeds, and those seeds basically will fall, break down, birds will eat them, other insects, any other type of animal eat them, and then that's how they spread typically. And this area, the purple coneflower, is actually native to this area. But the flowers that typically people are using in their landscapes and their are not typically native, but they've been hybridized in some way, shape, or form to give you that beautiful color.
Sure. And now you can get how many different colors?
Oh, my gosh.
And some kind of fun names, too. Like,
yeah.
You know, we're not going to just have it be red. It's going
right.
to be.
Right. Yeah. So yeah. You got some. Now you put me on the spot. But there are some crazy names that are out there. Powwow.
Raspberry tart.
There you go, yeah. Raspberry tart. And so there's lots of different colors, so there's lots of different flavors. And I call them flavors because when you really look at them, that's what you have to think. It's like that one looks orange, that one looks red, and it actually probably tastes orange just because of how vibrant those colors are.
Yeah.
They don't get a lot of them, they're not getting really, real tall. So they're probably in that foot to 18 inches height. Okay. The smaller stature of that plant kind of gives it a nice, that's a good place to put them right along a border next to some pavers or some rocks, because then that way they really like dry, they like heat, they're very tolerant of what our existing weather is, mm-hmm. except for the smokiness. I don't know how well they adapt to smoke.
Yeah. Wildfires, yeah, they've. You know, it has to be impacting plants
right.
as well as people. Yeah.
Right. So the flowers themselves, echinacea, have been around. They're constantly developing new ones, better ones, hardier ones. But it's a great plant to use, and especially if you can kind of use them in groupings of, 3 to 4 to 5 plants.
If you don't want to wait for the seeds, you can wait for that plant to grow and then split them and just kind of divide them like we've talked about before with a daylily or the hosta or anything like that. Is just take off a chunk of the side of the plant, dig down and around it, usually in the spring or the fall, and transplant it and water it in real well. And
do you cut them down when they're done, you know, blossoming, wilting? Do you leave them sit there? Like, what's the full impact of their beauty? Are they going to look gross at some point?
Well, yeah, so we're kind of getting to the tail end of nice flowering plants, and we're getting to the end of summer, and so those that's when things begin to kind of look tired and weathered. So
Me too.
Yeah, exactly. That's how we all feel, especially
after yesterday.
Not that
I want summer to end. Just a little tired and weathered from the heat and the dry. Yeah.
But, you know, when they are done flowering, they'll basically, their petals, you leave, the petals of the flowers fall off, and then that seed head stays there. Now, in some cases, it'll keep on putting energy into those seeds, and it'll just dry up, fall, and break apart. Or you can just trim that off, and then that way the energy for that plant sticks with that plant and sticks with the leaves and puts, and then basically puts a lot of more energy back into its root system. So
science.
Yeah.
As well as the art of all these beautiful colors. Right. It's pretty cool. Yeah. All right. There's a few ways you can be part of the SDPB gardening and growing community. Join us here on Thursdays with Eric Helland. You can always send him a question in the moment at sdpb.org, and we'll ask that question. You can also go to hashtag SDHomeGarden is where you can connect with other people on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, and sdpb.org/SDHomeGarden is your homepage for this. Eric Helland, thank you so much for being here. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Homegrown baseball lovers can now follow South Dakota's three teams in the Expedition League. The Sioux Falls Sunfish, Pier Trappers, and Spearfish Sasquatch rosters are made up of college baseball players who are college-age baseball players who are looking to prolong their careers, maybe possibly move up to minor league or major league baseball. The Sunfish are in the hunt for a second half division title. However, they have lost a few games recently, which places them about four games back behind the Fremont Moo. Zach Campbell is the assistant general manager of the Sunfish, and he joins me in SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. Zach, how's it going?
Oh, you know, it's going good today. We have had six straight home games the last couple of days, so it's nice to kind of get ready for our last two home games, But man, it's been a fun summer here in Sioux Falls.
This is a whole new league. It's relatively new. Pandemic was a tough time for it. Give us a little background on the Expedition League.
Yeah, so the Expedition League, its very first season was in 2018. Mm-hmm. So kind of funny enough, I actually worked for the team in Pierce, South Dakota as an intern during that year. So I've kind of known what the league's all about since it got started in 2018, but it's a collegiate wood bat league, so all of our players are current college players. That's the criteria that it has to be. So the youngest players we could get is someone that just graduated high school that's looking for some college ball experience before they go to school. And then I believe the oldest player we have is someone getting ready for their senior year. Mm-hmm. So these leagues operate all throughout the country, and ours just happens to be in the Midwest and got a bunch of great teams in North Dakota, South Dakota, Nebraska, Wyoming, Montana, Idaho, and Canada. So kind of in that whole geographic footprint. And yeah, it's just a great time, fun, family-friendly entertainment. And these college players get to play 64 games throughout the summer, get looked at potentially by some other colleges if they're looking to transfer, get looked at by MLB scouts if they're, you know, ready to maybe enter the draft, because they're all draft eligible being in college. And so it's just kind of a really unique experience and a good take on it. And they use wood bats, which they don't do in college baseball, which is kind of a great way to, you know, pay homage to what the MLB is like and give them that experience as well.
Yeah, so that's great for me as a fan, because that's what I want to see. Why is it good for the players to be all wood bat?
Yeah, it's and I didn't play baseball, you know, all the way through. I stopped playing baseball probably towards the beginning of my high school career. But from what I've learned from the players and talking to my general manager, who's been a professional scout with the MLB for 7 years remotely, so he knows what he's talking about when he talks about baseball. It's a little bit of a learning curve hitting with a wood bat. There's some mistakes you can make with a metal or composite bat that if you were to hit that with a wood bat, you wouldn't have as much success as you do. So it's good for them to get high-quality competition against a bunch of other good college players with that wood bat. So it's kind of a great way to get a feel for, you know, what it'd be like the life of a minor league baseball player, essentially.
All right. The sunfish players from what? How far and wide do they come from?
Yeah, you know, it's far and wide. You know, it's we have a healthy amount of good local talent. We have four kids from Augustana, which is where we actually play all of our home games out at Karis Park, which is just a beautiful field. We're so happy to be there. So we have four of those guys. We have another kid from Sioux Falls that is actually playing at Michigan State right now. And then another guy from Laverne, Minnesota. So a bunch of players from the area, another local Sioux Falls guy as well. But then we've had players from Hawaii, Texas, Nebraska, Louisiana, Georgia. Really just our coaches do a great job recruiting good college players from all across the nation. They all come here to South Dakota. Many of them have never ever been to South Dakota in their lives. And they come out here and they just get a great experience where not only do they get to make lifelong memories with their friends, their host families, whoever it may be, but they get to play a lot of baseball.
Yeah. Talk about the impact on the community then, because you do have these host families who are inviting regular players to come stay with them. And this, a lot of people don't know about the Expedition League yet because it is so new. This is your first season in Sioux Falls as a team, right? So from an entrepreneurial to an economic impact to the business to the, you know, just the family fun of coming out to see a game. Talk a little bit about that part of your mission.
Yeah, you know, it's a really unique prospect. It's obviously, like you said, our inaugural season. So I could talk to a lot of people in Sioux Falls and they might not have heard of us, or they ask, you know, well, did the Canaries change their name? But at the end of the day, it's just another avenue for families to have something to do in the summer. It's fun, family-friendly entertainment. And just being here in this inaugural season has been really cool. There's been a couple of kids that come to the games and they have a blast. We let them be bat boys. They talk to our players. We had a team that came in the other week and they played catch with the players beforehand. And then we actually brought them up in the booth and the kids took turns doing some of our PA reads. So it's just kind of a really cool experience where you get that feel for one, high quality baseball, because that's what it is. But then there's just a lot more to it. You know, there's in between inning activities where kids can participate in games and, you know, win prizes. And that's kind of the aspect, you know, from the fan. If you love baseball, you want to take in a summer night at a beautiful ballpark, it's a great opportunity to do it. But then there's a lot of avenues that, you know, we're trying to branch out into in the community in year two, year three. We wanted to start a sunfish reading program where we'd go into elementary schools and we would, you know, incentivize kids reading books. You know, do we give them free tickets, a hat? Do I bring our mascot in? You know, we unfortunately weren't able to get one this year due to, I mean, you know,
coming off of a pandemic.
Exactly.
It's,
there was guidelines, you know, where you get the mascot from and all that. But there's just kind of that thing where we want to be an integral member of the community for the host families kind of that you touched on. It's really cool because it's a way to serve the community. You know, they bring a player in. They have no idea, you know, who they are, where they're coming from. But over the course of 2.5 months, they become family.
Yeah.
And I can speak on that firsthand. I had a host family when I was in Pierre. And I still get Christmas cards from them. You know, my host mom checks in on me. I was just chatting with my host family. One of them had a birthday yesterday. And so gave them a quick text, you know. And it's just kind of this cool thing where you're bringing someone into your life. And so there's a lot of different impacts, too. And, you know, one I haven't touched on, too, is, you know, there's the way we can hopefully drive business to other small businesses, other businesses in the community, because collegiate woodbat's all about fun. And so it's kind of this unique prospect where we can like synergize what some companies want to do and market them. I know like McDonald's Heart to Heart got on board. And so if we score 10 runs at any game, we pass out free cheeseburger coupons to everyone. Mm-hmm. Remedy Brewing is another one of our partners. They're our official craft beer partner. And they're our strikeout tracker. And if you get enough people, it's know, it's just kind of a fun thing. But there's a lot of great local businesses that get on board.
What happened here is I got so into this that I realized that I hadn't looked at the clock in a while. So we're gonna wrap up and tell listeners thanks for listening, and we'll put some links up on our website so you can find out more about the Sioux Falls Sunfish.
Yeah.
Great logo, great hat. Zach, thanks for being here. We really appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you. And I'll just say we have two home games next Friday and Saturday, our last two. If you guys wanna check it out, go to tickets.SiouxFallsSunfish.com.
All right, thanks for listening. Thank you.